experience.
Batman experience.
Batman experience. Batman experience. Experience.
Welcome to the Pat Mayo Experience, presented by DraftKings 2021. Oscars, picks, bets, and preview is coming up this weekend. Remember to smash the like button for the episode and give me your favorite Oscars bet, which you can find at DraftKingsSportsbook.com right now to bet on. And I'm not talking about betting on a Best Director favorite that's minus 6,000. What's a reasonable bet that you might actually want to make? Because you're not risking $6,000 to win 100. I'm sorry to tell you about that. No one is doing that. So what's a reasonable Oscars bet that you have found? And therefore, you can put it into the comment section after smashing the like and subscribing to Mayo Media Network on YouTube, and download, rate, and review the podcast as well, along with subscribing. Joining me today to break this all down, it's a busy month for this guy. He's got a brand new season of The Challenge, a season of The Challenge wrapping up. WrestleMania just happened. Now it's Oscar season. Host of The Challenge Mania podcast, it is Scott Yeager. What's going on, man?
What's up, dude? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Here's the issue with the Oscars this year. I've seen one of the Best Picture nominees. This is the first year I haven't seen all of basically the Oscar-nominated movies across the board in, I want to say, 15 years. It just didn't pan out for me this time around. There's stuff going on in the world. I heard about this. I read about it online. I've been stuck in my house. You'd think I would have watched all this stuff, but just couldn't get myself up for it, to tell you the truth.
Well, I can let you know what I thought of them and you know what odds are holding true to the quality of the films and whatnot, which, as we know, the Oscars is always a perfect mirror of how great these movies truly are. But it's interesting you say that, Pat, because never have the films been easier to view for the common person. Not everyone gets SAG screeners like I do. But in general, this year, I would say 75% of these films either started on a streaming service or wound up on one by, you know, January or February. I think there were maybe two or three that you'd have to fork over maybe $15 or $20 for by Amazon Prime to rent. But even that is a lot easier than having to go to a theater, which is normally what you have to do in a regular calendar year. So I totally get the pandemic aspect of it. I get the kind of being disinterested. I get the quality of film maybe not being as exciting as normal because the Dunes and the Top Guns moved out of the calendar year. But I'm a little surprised, Pat, to hear you say you only saw one, and I kind of want to guess which one that is. I feel like I'll be wrong, but can I guess which one you've seen?
You can, because there's two I really want to see, and I blame the kids. Having two kids under two has really thrown off. Just when the kids go to bed, all I want to do is lay down and not watch a movie anymore. So hopefully by this time, actually earlier than this time next year, that I'll be fully prepped for the next one. That's why I had to have you on, because you need to tell me about these movies and what I need to see. That's essential viewing from it, because I've heard great things about a lot of them. But go ahead and take your guess, because I saw one of these and I didn't really like it.
Okay, well, so I'm going to use process of elimination. I'm going to say that the hardest movies to see were Minari and The Father, because those never truly hit a streaming platform. I would say that the ones that you kind of had to seek out, but obviously if you look at some of the favorites we're going to be talking about, are some of the, you know, the best betting predictors would be Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, and maybe if you want to throw in there The Trial of Chicago 7. That's the one, though, that I'm going to predict, because it's Aaron Sorkin, it's big flashy cast, and it dropped around October, where I think people were maybe thinking things were getting back to normal. It had like a big promotional release, got a great flashy cast, Sacha Baron Cohen, Aaron Sorkin. I'm going to guess that you saw The Trial of the Chicago 7.
You would be 100% correct on that. And shocker, not a best in any other year. That is not a Best Picture nominee.
Well, it's interesting because we're coming off of what I think was borderline the strongest year of the last decade, which officially just ended. I guess the decade starts in 2010, goes through 2019. I thought 2019 was the deepest year we've maybe ever had in the last 10 years. And a lot of the elite films of last year, Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, even Marriage Story, Uncut Gems, Jojo Rabbit, those are some of my favorite movies in recent memory. This year, though, I will say overall, the quality of film, I think, is a little lower. I think the fact that we don't have these big, exciting releases affects things. You don't have these zeitgeisty weekends or months where all your friends are seeing something in the theater around the same time, and it kind of has a moment. That being said, though, I will say I do feel like after a while I developed not just a personal connection to some of these movies, because I was at home and kind of left to my phone and my podcasts and my movies to kind of, you know, take ownership of my interests during a pandemic. But also I kind of fell in love with this lengthy awards season narrative that we had that's unlike any other. Normally you have the Oscars at the tail end of February, maybe early March. You have the Golden Globes in January, you have the SAGs in January. We're fresh into 2021 territory by now, and we're probably in the theater watching a Vin Diesel movie. But everything got pushed. You know, beginning of the pandemic, pretty much nothing came out for about 6 months. And the earliest you really started seeing any of the Oscar movies was November, but really stuff got pushed because we moved the Oscars to to April 25th. Stuff got pushed all the way to February, and you had movies not even debuting until February, which used to be unheard of. And I think what happened was a lot of people were used to seeing movies in theater around Christmas, around Thanksgiving with their family, starting to talk about them and get excited for them. And that did not happen this year. So that coupled with the slate that I think is a little lackluster to begin with. And I think this is a year that's going to be quickly forgotten.
I can see that. So I think the best movie I saw from last year was probably Palm Springs, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Yeah. Probably not a best picture type nominee, but far more enjoyable than I think it had any right to be. I feel like every Lonely Island movie is kind of like that. You're like, this premise is pretty stupid. I don't really know if Andy Samberg's a good actor, but then you watch it, you're like, this is pretty funny.
Well, what stinks is that I was hoping that in a year like 2020, where a lot of movies moved off the calendar, and as I said, the slate was maybe a little bit lackluster, I thought it would open the door for a movie like that to maybe at least sneak in for original screenplay. And I believe it did in a category at the Writers Guild Awards, and it did get nominated for Best Musical or Comedy at the Golden Globes. And so it did get a little bit of burn on the earlier award circuit. Unfortunately, it did get blanked at the Oscars, but Palm Springs is in my personal top five for the year. Came out towards the beginning of the pandemic, streamed on Hulu. I think it's just a really fun new take on the Groundhog Day format. And what's really cool is even if you've seen it already, if you go to Hulu and you click extras, or I believe one of the tabs there, they did a really cool thing where they did like a directors, the filmmakers and actors commentary for it. So if you want to relive the movie and watch it again with Andy Samberg and Christy Milioti and the director whose name escapes me, kind of walking you through every moment, talking to you about how it was shot and this and that, it's actually a really cool way to rewatch the movie. If you've gone a year since you've seen Palm Springs and you're like, I want to unpack that again, I recommend doing it with the commentary.
I found it strange that the Borat sequel didn't end up in the Best Picture category with its subject matter. Maybe it's because it's post-election that everyone ended up voting on this. I think if we kept the normal time for the Oscars, the political stance of that movie would have wedged it into the Best Picture conversation.
See, it's interesting you say that. I think Borat overachieved entirely due to its placement in the election year. And I think a lot of people subconsciously think it had a genuine effect maybe on the election. And if it did, great. Thank you very much, Sacha Baron Cohen. But I was a little bit, maybe I'm on my own island with this. I was a little disappointed with it. And I understand why. It's that, you know, obviously Sacha Baron Cohen, when he made the first Borat, and of course, when he made the Ali G show, was a relative unknown. And these characters were relatively unknown. Now that Borat was this huge hit that came out over 10 years ago, won, I believe, or was nominated for a screenplay award back then, and he's one of the most recognizable people on the planet, especially in that costume, you can't really run the same shtick again. So they bring in Maria Bakalova. She gets nominated for the Oscar. She's the one going in and doing all the stealth stuff, and they write this narrative about her being his daughter or sister. I can't even remember by now. And the whole thing is kind of hinging on this big stunt at the end that involves Rudy Giuliani. And look, I admire it, and I think it was relatively well done, but I don't think it reinvented the wheel. I don't think it should be nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars. I think, and this is what pains me about Palm Springs not being honored here, is that when you say, I love Palm Springs, but it's not really an Oscar movie, I say, but you're talking about the same year in which Borat's subsequent movie film is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. So to me, in any world where that is an Oscar nominee for adapted screenplay, where half of the people in it aren't even acting, they're just kind of in on a prank, I think that Palm Springs easily is a superior screenplay and should be nominated. So I know a lot of people love Borat too. I enjoy it. I watched it as soon as it dropped on Amazon. But to me, that's the epitome of a movie that is overachieving because of the election year and maybe the effect it had on it.
Yeah, and if it did, I don't know whether it did or whether it didn't, and I much prefer Palm Springs to Borat 2. Borat 2 was good. It was like almost your ultimate popcorn movie. I watched it, had a few laughs, and then I just kind of forgot about it, because even though it's like 20 years later at this point, it was just the same movie over again, but not as funny.
Well, also, what I thought was harder to watch about it was that the original movie, I forget exactly what year it came out in, but when he's showing you these real life people that are so like deplorable with their views and they're singing these songs, Down with the Jews and things like that, you can kind of laugh at it because you're like, okay, these people exist, but they're not doing so well in life. And here this movie drops and it's, you know, shining a light on a similar population of people smack dab towards the end of like a pretty good period for them. And like, you know, we have this year where obviously the pandemic is, you know, not necessarily directly tied to any one person, but you know, you watch this movie that shines a light on people who don't take the pandemic seriously. And of course, you know, a few months after the Black Lives Matter movement, the George Floyd murder and all this stuff that is very serious. To me, it was a little bit harder to laugh at these deplorable people having these rallies and these big parties and him going up there and singing these terrible songs that they immediately take to and sing along with. You know, maybe if I watch it again now, knowing what happened in November and then in January, maybe I'll be able to enjoy it a little more. But watching this in October, it was like a little too close to home. And maybe that was the point, but I wasn't able to like truly enjoy it like I enjoyed Borat 1. And seeing Borat 1 in the theater was one of the best in theater experiences I've ever had. It's truly, you know, hysterical. This one was like, oh, I kind of want to laugh, but I also kind of want to cry myself to sleep.
I mean, being an outsider in all of this, not being American, Canadian, so it hits a little bit differently. I just thought straight up the comedy just wasn't as funny the second time around.
I agree.
You know what the comedy is. There was something, although you saw Borat in bits and pieces on the Ali G show, the movie itself was just like, holy shit, like this is, I haven't seen anything like this. It's like the new, basically the seeds that were planted by Spinal Tap and the Christopher Guest movies have just been upped a level to this thing where they're interacting with real people all of a sudden. It's just like, it blew my mind. The first, it was 2006 when it came out, I think.
This movie is not going to be an Oscar contention next year, which should tell you something about how I feel about Borat 2 being in contention this year. But a movie that just hit Netflix called Bad Trip, which stars Eric Andre and Tiffany Haddish is in it. And it's kind of a fun new take on the Borat format of like half hidden camera prank, half narrative. And I think I enjoyed that more. Again, it's not exploring like a political territory and it is like kind of just kind of full on hidden camera prank, but within the construct of a narrative. I compare it a lot to Borat. I would highly recommend that. That's on Netflix. And I think if you are a fan of that format and just want to laugh unabashedly, I would check out Bad Trip.
Before we get into the bets, and I think we'll try to identify some bets that you can, you know, wager on at DK Sportsbook, and then maybe we'll just go through like pick by pick, and if people are filling out pools, maybe we'll split it up into two shows, something like that. But how much do you think that politics is going to weigh on this year's Oscars when it comes to the voting? Just as in, hey, we need, there's been more representation in the Academy, and sometimes that comes through when something like Moonlight ends up winning, and then it kind of goes back the other way when something like Green Book ends up winning. So I don't know if it's just a media narrative that there is this political effect on the Oscars for either good or for either bad, but certain categories or certain people or certain movies are going to get overemphasized and people will feel like, oh, I need to vote for this. This is an important movie. Or is that just something the media talks about that doesn't really exist?
Okay. So yes and no. I don't think, you know, if the Academy was one person or even 100 people, like it is sometimes for the Golden Globes, it's like 85 people. I would say it would be more possible for it to directly affect that, you know, because A, we're voting B. But I think more in line with what you said about, is it just a media thing? Yes, but also that media thing and what narrative takes hold and how early it takes hold can shape people's subconscious viewpoints and who they end up voting for. I don't think anyone truly votes for someone they don't believe deserves something. But when it comes to a tiebreaker, I think narrative is very important. You know, I mean, I think particularly in Best Actor this year, you have four, I think, but even if you want to throw in Gary Oldman, five really great performances. But I think among them, you have a potentially career best performance by Anthony Hopkins. You have two really great star-making turns by Steven Yeun and Riz Ahmed, who in a different year, maybe this is the crowning achievement for them. Maybe this is the send-off Oscar for Anthony Hopkins. But you have Chadwick Boseman, who of course is this big star. He's played Jackie Robinson. He's played the Black Panther. He's a megastar, but has never been truly honored for his acting. He delivers the best performance of his career in what is probably his last performance. And if it's not his last performance, it's certainly his last real great performance. And now you have a conundrum in that, wow, I have four performances, even throw in five if you love Oldman, that I really like. But there's only one of these people that I know for a fact I won't be able to vote for ever again. And, you know, for me, like I vote for the SAG Awards. And it's not that I voted for a performance I don't think is the best performance, but maybe I couldn't decide what the best performance was. And since they're so close, that narrative and that, hey, this is my last chance to honor Chadwick Boseman and to have that Oscar winner next to his name for not even the rest of his life anymore, but the rest of his legacy, I'm going to check that box. And that's something that nobody told me to do, but that's something that obviously you hear about, you read articles about, and obviously Chadwick Boseman has been talked about all year round. I mean, this pandemic hit and we're all in these, you know, terrible moods anyway, and we're, you know, looking at how long is this going to last and life can't get worse. And then all of a sudden that news snuck up on all of us. No one knew he was so sick, and this guy who meant so much to everybody and who people were probably binging his movies to get through the weekend during the pandemic, they find out that this true hero of Hollywood has been lost without any of us knowing it was even on the table. So I think that something like that, it's not a political thing, but it's a narrative thing, does play a part in the voting. And I think now when you look at the odds, it reflects that. And you look at the odds, it looks like Chadwick Boseman is light years better than those other men. He's not. And it looks like in a different year, he would be this runaway favorite. I don't know that he would be. Does that not say that he is the best performance? No, he very well might be. And he probably is to a lot of people. But when you get to 30-1 or 20-1 or whatever odds you're looking at, narrative has to be playing a part there. And I do say that in a elongated Oscar season that we've had, here we are in mid-April. It is now sunny again. The NCAA tournament is behind us. WrestleMania is behind us. It is unheard of that we have had this long to think about this Oscar season and these narratives. And Chadwick Boseman's narrative started all the way back in last June, or sadly when he passed away. So to me, it's not necessarily politics. It's not necessarily one issue or another. But yes, it does become the sort of media circuit and the narratives that permeate through these ballots and onto these blog posts and into these podcasts and things like that. Does that make someone vote for someone they don't love or want to vote for anyway? No, but it truly does often become the tiebreaker.
Let's talk about these best picture odds then. So once again, DraftKings Sportsbook, Nomadland is the betting favorite, -670 favorite. That means you would have to wager $670 to win $100 if Nomadland wins and you have bet on it. The Trial of the Chicago 7 is somehow 6-1 to win this award. Minari is 14-1, Promising One Young Woman, 17-1. Mank is actually the one that I really want to see. That and Sound of Metal are the two that have the most interest for me of the ones I haven't seen. But Mank's 33-1, Judas and the Black Messiah, 33-1, Sound of Metal, 50-1, and The Faja is 100-1. Probably not going to win. Probably if this was the BAFTA Awards, maybe it would have a much better chance with so many British people in the movie. But at the Academy Awards, I don't really see it. Is there any way that Nomadland doesn't win? Because I only say this because we came on the show last year and you won me a bunch of money, Scott, with all these Parasite underdog wagers, best picture, best director, best screenplay. Mm-hmm. We thought it was live for best picture, but the other ones were like, hey, if it wins best picture, it might win all these other ones. And then it did all of a sudden. And I cleaned up. It was great. So is there anything that you can see beating Nomadland, I guess is my question.
Here's what I'll say, and this is advice for future years. Obviously, it's too late this year, but I would, and I don't know how early DraftKings puts up their odds, but I would say that what's great about betting on the Oscars specifically, but film awards in general, is that there are precursor award shows that tell you things that by this week are all set in stone. And that's why we're starting with Best Picture. But when we go down the line here, more often than not, we're going to be talking about a heavy betting favorite. And more often than not, I am not going to lead you astray and tell you to take a dog, as sexy as some of those long odds might be. And at a show like the Golden Globes, where I hit a 16-1 underdog, Rosamund Pike, for Best Actress in a Comedy, that's possible where there have been no precursors and nobody really knows how these 85 Hollywood pundits from the Hollywood Foreign Press are going to vote. But by April 25th, by the time that these Oscars voters are voting, they've seen who's won SAG, they've seen who's won BAFTA, they've seen who's won Golden Globe, Critics' Choice, etc. And so have you. And I encourage people to put those dates on your calendar. And I encourage you, if you think that someone's going to come out with winning one of those, bet the day before. If they do win one of those and you look at the odds and they haven't moved yet, bet them that day. But Lord knows by this week, everyone, including Vegas, including DraftKings, has seen all of those precursors take shape, and they know probably how this is going to unfold. Last year, I thought that Parasite was a very live dog against 1917 because of how beloved a movie it was. It was a critic's darling. It was a fan favorite. It picked up the SAG Ensemble Award, and it was a nice upset pick in that it had the Moonlight thing going for it, but it was also, in a way, had become the populist pick because 1917 was the chalk that everyone is trying to move off of. This year, though, what's interesting and why I wouldn't tell you to do it, Nomadland is sort of both of those things. You know, Trial of the Chicago 7 was sitting in the pole position here, I would tell you vote Nomadland. But since it's Nomadland, I don't think Trial of the Chicago 7 is beloved enough to take on the momentum it needs to win here. It did win the SAG Ensemble. So if you're looking for a parallel between this and last year of Parasite, it did that. But I'll say the fact that Aaron Sorkin missed out on that director nomination was big for how I think that this voting body in the Academy views this movie. I think they look at it as a really well-made, pretty well-written, well-edited sort of TV-ish movie. And you see it there in that second place spot. I don't even know that when my brain starts racking for a spoiler, I go there. I go Promising Young Woman or Judas and the Black Messiah, maybe even a Minari. Those are the movies that I think if something's going to overtake Nomadland, it does so based on the fatigue of having been told as a voter, you're going to vote Nomadland, right? And probably been told that for going on 6-7 months now. If after a while that gets old and you feel like you want to honor a movie you loved more, I don't think many people love Trial of the Chicago 7 more than Nomadland, but you might have that with Judas. You might have that with Promising Young Woman, maybe even Minari. The problem is, those three films, you might have three different people who put those number one, but what's probably their number two? Nomadland. So this is not where I'd go. I think it's Nomadland taking Best Picture this year.
I would say, just based on the perception of these movies that I've encountered, that Minari would probably be the upset pick in the spot at 14-1 if you were to go down that road, solely because people feel really happy with this movie. And over the past year, just a happy movie seems pretty good to people.
Yeah, what I'll say is, though, since Yoo Young Jin has taken on the favorite role in the Best Supporting Actress category, and she was an underdog before SAG, plus 160 is what I got her at, and then she won SAG, she won BAFTA, and now she's a pretty hefty favorite. That, I think, becomes for me the way that this movie gets honored. And I am not saying that it's not impossible that this could happen, but you remember that last year was the very first time that a foreign language film won Best Picture in Parasite. You know, happened to be the same language that is spoken in this film. Now, it should be mentioned, this is not a foreign language film. It is not an international feature, although 90% of the movie is in Korean. It is an American movie. It is an American production, and it is not in the international feature category. It is not going to take that prize like normally it would. If you have a movie that's in another language up for Best Picture, it's a runaway to win international feature. But this movie is not an international feature. It takes place in Arkansas. It was made by an American production team. So interestingly enough, it's a movie that people kind of view as that, but it is not being treated like that voting wise. And I do think coming on the heels of Parasite, having that groundbreaking year and doing that, I don't see it happening two times in a row, even though technically this mainly Korean spoken movie is an American film. I do feel like subconsciously people aren't going to go for that twice in a row. And I think that Yoo Young Jung is getting the recognition for the film itself. So as much as I would probably put that third behind Promising Young Woman, which I think if Promising Young Woman picks up original screenplay, which is the favorite to do so, if it picks up Best Actress, it's possible. Again, I am not telling you to do it, but it's possible. Same goes for maybe Judas and the Black Messiah. You know, best performance of the year, I think, by Daniel Kaluuya. He's a runaway for supporting actor. I don't know what else it would pick up there, but it got 6 nominations, more than anyone predicted. Got a cinematography nomination, got a screenplay nomination. So that movie performed better on the nomination side than people thought. I did kind of think that to have a chance of winning here, it would have had to pick up a precursor or two along the way, other than Kaluuya. It hasn't so far. This is Nomadland's year. And I think I'm not mad at it because I really like Nomadland. I've watched it twice. I think it's delightful. I think Frances McDormand's great. I think the untrained actors in it are really great and magnetic. It's really well shot. So again, was it my favorite movie of the year? No, but it's in my top five. And I think during this preferential ballot period that we have here with the Oscars, unless you have a really strong number two, like what I think Moonlight was for a lot of people, or a really strong, you know, number one for people, even though a lot of people like La La Land, a lot of people were putting Moonlight number one, you know, and then Moonlight was probably number two for a lot of the people who had La La Land number one. I don't think you have that this year. I think it's too split. I think that Nomadland is pretty much unconditionally beloved. And I think among the other films, they're kind of polarizing.
The one I see from deep down on the list, and I don't know if it's going to happen. I mean, it probably won't happen in the Best Picture category. Maybe it's like cinematography. Not quite sure. But Mank is a movie about Hollywood, and movies about Hollywood tend to overperform at the Oscars.
Yeah, and that was, I think, the narrative that, you know, if you asked me and a lot of people in November before anyone saw the movie, I would have told you, yeah, this might get David Fincher his first Best Directing Oscar, you know, lock it up for cinematography, maybe even score. And ironically, the composers of this film are going to win Best Score, but for another film, they're double nominated here. Shouts to Nine Inch Nails' Trent Reznor and his partner Atticus Ross. But this movie's been underperforming across the board. It did just pick up the American Cinematographers Association Award recently. It is still viewed as an underdog in that category to Nomadland. But hey, if you want to bet this as a dog in cinematography, I'm all for it. I think Amanda Seyfried is a potential upset pick in supporting actress, but I think it has zero chance in Best Picture here. I really do. It's a movie I wanted to love, and I've tried to watch it a couple times. I did watch it once, but have since tried, and I just don't think there's enough there. I think this movie was a passion project for Fincher. It's made by a 20-year-old script written by his father, who has since passed away, and it feels like a movie that was written 20 years ago, and it doesn't really feel like a movie that has that Fincher third act that makes you feel like, all right, this is why David Fincher made this movie. If you ask me why David Fincher made this movie, it's because he wanted to make this movie for his dad and, you know, to maybe honor their relationship in this movie that he had written and this passion his father had had. And it feels like when Fincher's in his wheelhouse with a Gone Girl or a Social Network or a Fight Club or a Seven, I mean, that is the filmmaker that I think deserves to be honored here at the Oscars. And this one, look, he still got the nomination. This still, I think, led with 10 nominations, but I look at it as probably having like an Irishman level, you know, kind of, you know, maybe going 0 for 10, maybe 1 for 10 as far as picking up awards here on Sunday.
Well, I mean, I assume the visual effects are better than the Irishman, although I think the Irishman won visual effects somehow.
No, it ended up losing, but I thought that was a live dog to win visual effects.
They were so bad, though.
Yeah. You know what it was, though. But again, to talk about those narratives and those articles and stuff, it's like you had read so many articles about how the movie cost $200 million. And a lot of that was the effects budget. And we did the de-aging stuff. And sometimes stuff just gets talked about so much that it becomes so, you know, and with this, it's actually interesting. These effects in Mank are kind of like not showy effects. You know, it's not Thanos, you know, it's not like a King Kong and Godzilla. It's like recreating the backdrop of a scene. You don't even realize half of it is digital effects kind of thing. So it could, you know, I think that it's not, I think visual effects is probably a two horse race between Tenet and Midnight Sky. But I think that Mank is something that in a different year, how about that? Since we've evolved to the point where movies like Get Out are winning Best Original Screenplay, and a movie like Promising Young Woman is so nominated for Sunday, and since the voting body has evolved so much, and I think we've had so many years, like the Artist year, you know, like I feel like the year that the Artist dominated, Mank would have dominated. You know, but I think since we've had that year, I think we're moving past it. I think you see the British period dramas, they pick up an acting award and that's it, but they get a lot of nominations. And I think similarly, the movies about Hollywood, you know, the Argos, you know, won because I guess it's about Hollywood and you had the Artist and things like that. But I think we're moving past it. And I think this will have more of like a Hugo performance, to use another movie that was kind of about filmmaking, but not really. And so I don't see it with Mank. I don't know anyone who truly loved it. And that's the thing, is that I think in a year where most of these candidates, you can find a few people who truly loved them or loved something about it. Mank, I think, was pretty disappointing to people and had a lot of reasons to love it. It just didn't deliver on them.
So if you had to personally put in your preferential ballot for Best Picture based on the movies that you liked the best of the 8 nominations, what would be the top 5?
So, you know, I mentioned before Palm Springs being in my top five films of the year. So the three movies that are in the Best Picture race that are in my top five favorite movies of the year was my favorite film overall was Promising Young Woman by a hair over Judas and the Black Messiah. Then I had a movie that, you know, didn't really get any recognition here, but was nominated for Best Actress at the Golden Globes, which is called I Care a Lot on Netflix, starring Rosamund Pike.
Hold on. Yeah. I actually did see that, and I absolutely loved it. There are people who really seem to hate that movie.
Really polarizing, really seemed to bother people. I mean, to me, it's like the scam that the movie's about. I don't want to say too much. It's like a very deplorable scam. And, you know, elderly people are the victims in it and whatnot. But I thought I described it to people. Everyone I described it to and told to see loved it. I said, hey, if the character she played in Gone Girl had a second career as a scam artist, this is about that part of her life. You know, very similarly told with heavy voiceover, very well shot, cool music. Then it has this whole second act where, you know, they introduce Peter Dinklage and it's kind of like takes this turn you aren't expecting, becomes another movie. And I think the ending wraps it up really well. So I really love that movie. I would have loved to see it get a screenplay nomination. I know it has some problems later on in the movie. A couple things happen. You're like, I'm not buying that. But if people watching this or listening to this are looking for something to watch, it's not going to win you any Oscar pools. But I Care a Lot on Netflix, I think, was the most original movie of the year outside of maybe Promising Young Woman. So that was my three. Palm Springs was my four. And then at five, I have Nomadland, which again, I thought was a delightful movie. And, you know, when I say I have it below Promising Young Woman and Judas and the Black Messiah, you know, those movies just hit me a little bit harder. And I thought, you know, particularly, you know, the formats of both of them I felt were very original, but I thought Promising Young Woman was just, you know, really, really great. Well done. I would highly recommend you check that out. If you're asking what the first one you go for on this list is, I would say that. So those are, I think, my power rankings. My preferential ballot would start that way. It would go Promising Young Woman, Judas and the Black Messiah, Nomadland. And again, that might be enough to get Nomadland over the finish line. The fact that the people who maybe even prefer other films still have Nomadland up high. After that, I'd probably go Minari. Then probably I would say, what am I forgetting here? The Father, Mank. Mank would be towards the end. And Trial of Chicago 7, you know, here's the thing about Trial of Chicago 7 that I feel bad for. It's taking on this villainous role that a Green Book developed. And obviously after winning, you know, I think people remember because it won. And I think Bohemian Rhapsody is another movie that because Rami Malek ended up winning over Bradley Cooper and some other more beloved and probably better performances. I think that movie was so overly nominated that people have started to spite those movies. And rightfully so in some regards. I don't know that people should hate Trial of Chicago 7 as much as they do. I think people are preemptively assuming that Sacha Baron Cohen upsets Daniel Kaluuya, or it upsets Nomadland, or that Aaron Sorkin was going to take a director slot from Emerald Fennell or something. And none of that happened and probably is not going to happen. So I thought Aaron Sorkin made a pretty damn good movie. I think the issue is that in a year where, and again, that movie is about, you know, six white guys and one black man who are put on trial. And, you know, the black man, Bobby Seale, kind of exits halfway through the movie. And it's really about these six white guys and the protesting they did. And that's fine. And that's what that movie's about. And very tangentially in that movie, you do have the death of Fred Hampton. It's actually, there is a scene where they take Bobby Seale into a room while he's being held. And they tell him that, you know, Fred Hampton was just murdered. And so in a way, they're both about a very similar, this and Judas and the Black Messiah are about a very similar time period. Of course, Judas and the Black Messiah centers on Fred Hampton himself, you know, the plot to infiltrate the Black Panthers and eventually murder him. And I think to me, that's the movie that resonated with me more. I think it's a little bit better. And sadly, I think Trial of the Chicago 7 is the one that's been honored a little bit more as far as taking home wins, where you look at Sorkin winning a Golden Globe for screenplay and you look for it winning the SAG Ensemble. Other than Daniel Kaluuya and a bunch of nominations, and Lakeith Stanfield gets nominated in a surprise turn for the Oscars, that didn't really win across the board. So I think people are looking at it as a little bit of an Oscar so white situation where it's like, hey, in a year where you have this great movie with a, you know, all black producing team that's about Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party and this and that, and this is the movie that's supposed to be happy to be there and getting nominated, whereas Trial of Chicago 7 is the one that's winning all the awards and it's the one with the white director and about the six white guys on trial during this, you know, tumultuous time, that feels a little wrong. And I agree, I just feel like we're a little preemptive with it running away with the awards because it really hasn't yet. And I don't think it's going to. I think at most Trial picks up one on Sunday, maybe two. And I think that will, you know, eventually you look at the scorecard, will be pretty similar to Judas and the Black Messiah. So it's becoming the villain movie of the year. And I don't think it deserves that. And do I think it's as good as those other movies? No, but I don't think it's a Green Book. And I don't think it has the really, truly problematic aspects of it that some other films in the past, Driving Miss Daisy, have had. And I think that it's getting rushed into those categories by some pundits and podcasters, some out of boredom, some out of their hatred for the movie. And I wouldn't say that. I'm with you that it's not the best movie of the year, but I don't think it's undeserving of the 7 or the 6 spot here in this list.
I don't think that it's bad, but I think that you kind of stumbled across it. It felt sort of like a TV movie, or it would have been better off being like a 4-part miniseries or something.
Yeah. And look, and I thought, again, maybe it's because I watched it on my TV and it was one of the first, like, to me, legitimate films to hit my screen during this pretty lackluster year, not just for movies, but for my life, that I enjoyed it. And, you know, Michael Keaton comes in a bit of, I don't know if it's a surprise cameo, but has a great scene. And when you look at it and like Frank Langella is like the 8th candidate to maybe get nominated here, I'm astounded that Sacha Baron Cohen's the one who's been running away with all the nominations, because I thought Mark Rylance was better. I thought Frank Langella was better. I thought even Joseph Gordon-Levitt was great. Michael Keaton, as I mentioned, I thought Yaya, who plays Bobby Seale, was great. So, you know, I thought it was a very deep cast, very well casted. I thought that the award it got at the SAG Ensemble was very well due. I voted for the film in a year that I thought had a lot of great ensembles. I thought that's something this movie did very well. That being said, though, is it the best movie of the year? No. And I think people are worried that we would look back on this year and it would have been the one that we'd have to look back on. Oh, that Trial of Chicago 7 won when we had all these great other movies that meant so much more. And I think, yeah, the people who wrote those articles for the past 6 months won, and this movie is not going to win on Sunday. So finally, let's dig it out of the doghouse. And maybe I think some of the people who stumble upon it in August, if they didn't see it, are going to be like, wow, that was good. Why did everyone tell me I was going to hate it? You know, and I think it's because people were so worried that that movie would win on the heels of the Parasite win last year. As you mentioned, the Oscar has this kind of weird cyclical thing where it's like one for you, one for us kind of thing. It's like, all right, Moonlight, you know, you go and win in this big surprise turn. One of the, I think, best picture winners we've had, as far as, you know, very small movie, very personal movie that ended up winning in a year where La La Land seemed to be the shoe-in, and then circle back and now you're giving one to The Shape of Water, or you're giving one, which I don't think a lot of people felt was deserving. And then now you have Roma, is everyone loves this movie, but it goes to Green Book. And now we come back around and Parasite wins. Similar to last year, though, people were trying to turn 1917 into the villain of last year. And just because Parasite was my favorite movie last year doesn't mean I didn't really love and respect 1917 as well. So I think with this, is it my first favorite movie of the year? No, but among the Best Picture nominees, you know, it's probably my 6th or so. And I think it's a well-made movie and Aaron Sorkin did a pretty good job. So, you know, I encourage people not to write it off as the villain of the awards year yet, because I don't think getting some of these nominations really hurt anybody. And I don't think it's going to take anybody's Oscar on Sunday.
Live sports can't always be on, but thankfully, HBO Max's shows and movies can bring the latest action right to your couch. From epic HBO originals, Game of Thrones, which is celebrating 10 years this month, and The Nerves, to WB same-day premieres like Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat! Available in theaters and on HBO Max for a limited time starting April 23rd. HBO Max is the perfect option for your team's off day. Go to hbom.ax/DraftKings. That's hbom.ax/DraftKings to start streaming now. Once again, remember you hear it, hbom.ax/DraftKings. Back to the show. So for actual bets, we're not going to be betting on Best Picture because we're not going to lay the juice with Nomadland. What are our actual bets? We don't need to go category by category. We'll make our Oscar picks here in part two of this show, where we just go category by category, no odds, and figure it out. But left on the betting board, what are actual things that you could be targeting now that aren't just substantially heavy favorites?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, and it's not as if there haven't been some heavy favorites that end up getting upset. Recently, Glenn Close was a heavy favorite the year that she famously lost to Olivia Colman. We mentioned La La Land losing to Moonlight. Depending on when you met Moonlight, it was when you bet them, it might have been 7-1. This year, though, I think the following are locked up. I think Nomadland for Best Picture. I think Chloe Zhao for Best Director. I think Chadwick Boseman for Best Actor. And I think Daniel Kaluuya for Best Supporting Actor are all locks. If you want to throw in score and animated feature for Soul, throw those into, those are locks. Ironically, in both female acting categories, you have live odds, very live odds. And I think what's interesting about supporting actress is that it's particularly a couple of weeks ago, this was as live as Best Actress. But since Yo Young Jung has won the SAG and the BAFTA, she's taken the, now she's minus 500. See, I got her 2 weeks ago at plus 160. So you see, you know, in a wide open category, what just a couple precursor wins can do for your odds here. So now you really can't bet her, but here's what I'll say. It's unlikely, but I like sometimes to have a little fun with something that I could see happening, you know, and I could maybe see after a couple years ago, her losing, as I just mentioned, when she was a heavy favorite, she's still not an Oscar winner, as hard as it is to believe, that it's possible Glenn Close takes home the Oscar on Sunday. And if it happens, it's 10-1. Is it worth 10 bucks? Maybe. Now, the reason I don't think it happens is, and the reason I ended up betting Yo Young right after she won the SAG is, you mentioned that narrative and you mentioned, do politics play a part? And it's one of those things where, you know, Glenn Close is, I think, a great performance in a really terrible movie. She's actually subsequently nominated for the Razzie for that same movie. And I don't think that's going to be the movie to push out Yo Young Jung, who's probably the lone winner for a very beloved movie in Minari. I don't think Olivia Colman has the oomph to do that. I don't think that Maria Bakalova can do that for a movie that I think even is overachieved by getting her nominated there. The one person I could maybe see also is Amanda Seyfried getting in there, because she is the narrative of the ingenue that people like to kind of anoint. And, you know, similar to Alicia Vikander a few years ago, maybe this is kind of the start to her big awards career. But I'll say this. I think that you throw in the SAG Award, you throw in the BAFTA Award, and you throw in the fact that this movie is about the Asian American experience. It is about a family of Korean people who bring their grandmother with them and move to Arkansas and try to make it with low-level jobs and also start their own farm. And it's the American dream, and it's, you know, it's their story. It's told very personally in their own language. And this year, you know, tragically so, you know, in the U.S., you know, every day, and especially I live in New York City, so here it's really bad. You're reading about all these crimes against Asian Americans and Asians and basically people taking out their frustrations about this awful year we've had on them. And it's disgusting. And this movie, I think, you know, could not have come at a better time for being this, you know, this beacon of hope and light as far as, hey, you know, especially to the Asian Americans, to say a lot of us are here with you and for you and look down on the way that you've been treated recently and especially in the last year. And I think that this movie, you know, is something where, you know, the narrative of this I've been told that she's had such an illustrious career in Korean film, and this is pretty much her coming out party as far as in the States. I think that you throw in a little bit of that narrative in the fact that, hey, you know what? Like, I love this movie. This movie spoke to me, and it was, you know, 2 hours of my life that I got to spend in this very personal story of what it's like for Korean immigrants here in the United States trying to make it and how they're treated and whatnot. And I think that all of that is really why she's becoming this runaway favorite in the category. I think, you know, we're going to talk about Best Actress in a second here. I don't think any of these are transcendent performances. I think Daniel Kaluuya is a transcendent performance. I think that in Best Actress, we have a few of them. And I think in this one, you have a lot of really solid performances. And I think that when you throw in that narrative I just discussed, that is what put Yo Young Jung over the top here. And I think that's why she's going to win. But if you want to throw a flyer on Seyfried or Close, I wouldn't be mad at it, but just do not do it with an amount of money that's going to hurt you.
Well, Best Actress is actually open. It's the one of the major categories where there is no prohibitive favorite here. And I guess that speaks to the quality of the performances this year. The only thing that I can't wrap my mind around is I just can't see Frances McDormand winning a third Best Actress Oscar, especially after winning 2 years ago.
Here's the thing. So this is how that other category looked 2 weeks ago. And what changed were two back-to-back wins for Yeo Young Jung, whose name I hope I'm not butchering, but I, you know, those two things right there were enough to take her from plus 160 in a lot of spots to now minus 500. The thing that changes here is that pretty much these women have split all the precursor awards. Carey Mulligan won Critics' Choice. Andra Day won the Golden Globe. Frances McDormand won the BAFTA. Viola Davis won the SAG. Vanessa Kirby, probably you can see, has the longest odds. She hasn't really won anything, but she has been a lock for that fifth spot across the board, even in some spots where Andra Day wasn't even nominated. You know, Andra Day was not nominated at SAG. Vanessa Kirby still was. So that's what changes it here, is that not having that extra one or two wins for someone else. You know, I think had Carey Mulligan won the BAFTA or something like that, or won the SAG, she would probably be the negative odds favorite here. Here's what I'm thinking with this. And, you know, what's interesting is that I actually bet Viola Davis to win the Globe and was surprised when she didn't. That award went to Andra Day. Now, if you have Viola Davis winning the Globe and you have then Viola Davis winning the SAG and everything else happens exactly how it happened, Viola Davis is probably a 6-1 favorite to win on Sunday. I think Andra Day winning that Golden Globe Award was a bit of a fluke. I think it was a bout of Globes going to do what Globes do. I think it was, they like to sort of, again, kind of, you know, crown that new leading actress and kind of give someone maybe an award a little bit earlier than they truly deserve it. They like to be first, especially in TV categories. You'll see they like to kind of be first and preempt the Emmys in a lot of ways and give people that first award. And sometimes in order to do so, they kind of overshoot it. And so that's where I saw Viola Davis winning and she didn't win. Because of that, and since she hadn't won anything since, she had sort of fallen into the Vanessa Kirby territory of, is she just going to be nominated every time and not win anything? Cue the SAG Awards, and she picks up that win. And now I'm starting to think, is she really, I think, the front runner here, Viola Davis? Viola Davis has won, but in supporting. We haven't had a Black woman win in Best Actress since Halle Berry. So it's still a great story there. Yes, it's her second best, it's her second Oscar, but it would be her first Best Actress Oscar. You go to narrative as a tiebreaker, that's still something that's going to feel very special. Now, is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom the kind of movie that takes home Best Actress and Best Actor? When I saw it, I didn't know that it necessarily should be or would be, but when you look at it, you think about it and you go, you know, the movie's called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, even though she doesn't have a lot of screen time in it. She's fantastic in it. She's Viola Davis. You know, a lot of people think she's the Meryl Streep of her generation. If she is, she wins this award, because Meryl Streep wins awards for movies like The Iron Lady that nobody even saw that year. They just checked the box. And when you take on that mantle of this is the best actress working right now, sometimes you win some when maybe you weren't the best performance in a year, but when it's hard to decide, people check your box. So I actually would go Viola Davis here. You get slightly better odds with her than you do with Mulligan. And I think that, you know, I think all you do is swap that Andra Day for Viola Davis Golden Globe. And I think she's minus 600 here. So I think it's a great value for Viola. You could have got her even higher. I think it was plus 700 or so before she won SAG. I agree with you on Frances. I think if Frances hadn't won for Three Billboards, she would run away with this. I think she is fantastic in Nomadland. She's sharing the screen in this movie with people who legitimately live in their cars and legitimately are not actors and actresses. They all do very well in their own right, but she seems as authentic as them. And when you think about the fact that this is a, you know, multimillionaire, two-time Oscar winner, and I believe that this woman, you know, loves and lives in her car. And I truly believe it. And I think it's one of the most realistic, you know, performances I've ever seen. That being said, I think, you know, when you look at the film being already honored for Best Picture, already honored for probably Best Director, maybe Best Cinematography, potentially Best Adapted Screenplay. Does it need this? Probably not. Does she need this? Probably not. I think Viola Davis is the play here. A lot of people still wishful thinking with Carey Mulligan. I voted for Carey Mulligan for the SAG Award because I love that movie so much. And I think she's great in it, but I love this movie so much. And this is one of the few spots I think it could pick up a second statue on Sunday. I just haven't seen her win other than the Critics' Choice. So I don't get why she's the favorite here. I would probably have these odds flopped. I would have Miss Viola Davis in the pole position, but hey, take the extra odds. And I think Viola Davis is the play. And look, if you lose, you know, it's not the end of the, it's probably not the end of the world, because at 2-1, you don't have to lay down that much to have like a smile on your face if she does win.
No, for sure. Can you discuss what member of the SAG voting, the Screen Actors Guild, makes up a part of the Oscars as well? Because isn't the acting body the largest body in the Academy Awards?
Yes, but so, okay. So basically, so if you are an actor in the Screen Actors Guild, you vote for the Screen Actors Guild Awards, right? So I've been in the Screen Actors Guild for 4 or 5 years now. So every year I get the screeners of the films that are nominated. I get to go to a lot of talks and in-person events when they happen, obviously not last year. And then I get to vote. Alongside me and every other person who's ever been in the union and has paid all their dues and stuff like that, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of actors. Okay. Now, among that huge body of actors voting for the Screen Actors Guilds, a small percentage of them have been invited to be a part of the Academy. And to do that, you have to have either won an Oscar, been nominated for an Oscar, have a very storied career, things of that nature. And over the last few years, they've made an effort to invite people for diversity reasons and for youth reasons and to try to change the voting body of the Academy. And one of the, you know, sort of easiest ways to do that is through actors, because I think, you know, some of the youngest people that, you know, from the voting bodies potentially are in the acting category just by nature of how early people start acting. So you've got a lot of newer actors and younger actors joining recently, but for a long time there, it was pretty much people who had won or been nominated for Oscars. So although it is makes up the largest portion of voters for the Oscars, it is still also a very, very small percentage of the actors that make up the Screen Actors Guild Awards voting body. And that's why it's not rocket science that if you win the SAG, you win the Oscar. Something that also happens with the SAG that I know I'm guilty of as well is that we have this thing called the SAG Ensemble Award, which I love, which is basically honoring the whole, not the entire cast of a movie, but all the major cast members of a movie. They'll list kind of all the names, and it's basically, you know, your top 10 performers in a movie. And so what that will sometimes do is give you a second opportunity to honor a performer by having their ensemble win, which will sometimes divert you for voting for them in the category where they would only be nominated at the Oscars. There is no ensemble category at the Oscars. It's sort of the best picture-ish thing that the actors do. So that sometimes throws things off. And I think also sometimes you get weird, you know, nominations. Amy Adams was nominated instead of Andra Day. So you look at it here and it's like, if Andra Day is going to be the one to upset Viola Davis, she couldn't even do that at SAG. SAG's gone rogue a few times. You had Emily Blunt won for A Quiet Place. She wasn't even nominated for the Oscar. You know, I believe Idris Elba won for Beast of the Southern Wild. What was the movie? It was a Netflix movie. Fantastic. Idris Elba won for that movie, and he wasn't even nominated for the Oscar. So that happens quite often. And some people chalk it up to the actor's mentality. Sometimes I think, you know, you get a thing where, you know, people can be extra beloved among their peers. And I know it's impossible that Viola Davis has worked with, you know, 300,000 people, but it's kind of just a different viewpoint. Whereas the Academy still has a lot of old hat, you know, it has a lot of old, you know, publicists and cinematographers and directors and people who, you know, you can vote, you essentially don't get like aged out, you know? And here's the thing with the Oscars, you don't have to prove that you've seen all the movies. And I think that, you know, it was very easy to watch Ma Rainey's Black Bottom this year. Very easy to watch. It was on Netflix beginning, I believe, in November. And especially since Chadwick Boseman has become the shoe-in that he has for Best Actor, I like to think that some people might say, all right, I'm probably voting for him, but I should probably see it first. And when you see it, you see this great performance by Viola Davis too. I mentioned it, Promising Young Woman, you probably got a screener at some point, but dude, even that extra having to put a DVD in can be annoying. So I think Viola Davis is the play here. And I would love it if Carey Mulligan won, but I don't think it's going to happen.
So down the board, maybe some of the technical categories, do you see any sort of value with these betting odds?
So again, I feel really bad because, you know, we're doing this the week of, and I think, you know, sometimes I like to strike early, strike fast. And so I made the play on Yo Young Jung a couple of weeks ago that has now become a prohibitive betting favorite. Similarly in cinematography, I got Nomadland at 2-1. If you want to pull that up, I'm unaware of exactly what it's at now, but I think it's moved a little heavier. Okay, so it's doubled. It's minus 400. Here's what I'll say here. Mank picked up the Cinematography Guild Award, and what I will say is it scared me. So having put down a little bit of a chunk of change on Nomadland, because I had to, because it was a 2-1 favorite, when I saw Mank win there, my heart skipped a beat. So if you want to throw a couple coins on Mank here at plus 350, it got the precursor it needed to. Now, here's the reason I love Nomadland at minus 200, and I still love him at minus 400, but obviously not as much. Those aren't the type of bets I like to make. But if you're in a parlay situation somehow, you know, I would maybe tack it in there. And certainly for the Oscar pools we're talking about. Nomadland star, in addition to Frances McDormand, who almost strips herself down to where she's not even like feeling like a star. She feels like a nomad. She feels like one of these people, and you're kind of just observing. Like, the movie almost feels like a doc. And that to me is a credit to her performance. But because of that, it makes the star of the movie the cinematography. Because Chloe Zhao went out there and shot all this stuff at like what they call magic hour, where pretty much you have these gorgeous sunsets and these landscapes of the lower Midwest throughout this entire movie. And she's got these great tracking shots where she's kind of behind Frances McDormand, but really the frame is taken over by these gorgeous scenics and stuff. And so I think this, for the same reason that she's the shoe-in for best director in a movie that really is not like a showy director's movie, part of the reason is that eye for the lighting and the scenics that this movie has. And so I think cinematography, which I believe she might even be the one getting the award, I think is kind of that double dose of honoring the part of the movie that really stood out to the most people. So if you're cool with minus 400, I would take it. And I would definitely take it in the pools there. The only one I think that is still remaining in kind of safe bet territory as far as how the odds are still scattered, if you want to pull it up, is probably adapted screenplay. We can take a look at where that's looking right now.
It is minus 400 for Nomadland is the favorite.
So this one I think has some live dogs. So I think that, you know, Nomadland is a movie much like 1917, where, you know, the way 1917 was like, you know, it's like one shot, you know, and you don't really think too much about the screenplay of it. Similar with this, so many of these people were real people. And, you know, you wonder how much of this is actually on the page. And, you know, it's almost like the credit that you give it for these other aspects of the film, does that detract from the credit you give it as a page work? And that's why I think you have a couple of live dogs in The Father and Borat. Now, Borat won the Writers Guild Award, but Nomadland was not eligible. So that's always the thing where this happens a lot, because you have people who are ineligible because they're not a member of the Writers Guild. You have, or there's other reasons as well why movies will not qualify. So you have a movie win the big shiny writer precursor while having not actually defeated the favorite for the Oscar. So again, if you want to throw a couple of coins down on The Father, or which I believe won at the BAFTA, or the second one was Borat, which won the Writers Guild, I'm not mad at it. Again, when you get down here to the last week, you see a lot of those minus 200s, those minus 175s turn into the minus 400s you see today. And if you're like me, minus 400 is too rich for my blood too, so I understand. That's why I really encourage people to try to get in before the BAFTA, try to get in before the SAG or the Writers Guild Awards, but also try to get in before the average bettor even starts thinking about the Oscars. You know what I mean? There's no mistake that you hit me up to talk about the Oscars 5 days before the Oscars. That's how most people think about the Oscars. Hey, Carol, want to come over? We'll get some chips. You know, Laura, you know, only assholes like me are thinking about the Oscars in January, February, March, and April, you know, and whatnot. But that's where sometimes there's some ability to strike and to kind of get some odds that don't even exist anymore. So I know I'm a broken record, but for next year, if you want to write that down, put these precursor award shows in your calendar and look at the odds the next day. Go to DraftKings, look at how they take shape either the day before or after some of these, when these presumptive winners take home that win or sometimes get upset. And you can treat that either way. Sometimes a precursor can work in your favor in that, hey, Mank just won the cinematography award. Maybe that means that some more people are going to bet on Mank and not on Nomadland, and you can swoop back in on Nomadland. Or maybe it's the other thing where, you know, winning the SAG award is all you needed to give you the confidence to vote for Yoo Young Jung, and then boom, you can still get her at 160, and now here we are the week of, and she's minus 500. So if memory serves me, I think, man, a lot of the ones that I was looking at that were live, you know, makeup, I think now throw another award at Ma Rainey. I think that's kind of taken the heavy favorite position. Sound, I believe, is 10-1 in favor of Sound of Metal. I think people kind of pencil in. Sound is in the title. We should give it this award. Why don't you pull up visual effects if you have that? I think there's maybe a little bit of money to be made there. So Tenet's the heavy favorite here. However, Tenet is one of my favorite movies of the year, and I've seen it underperform across the board. I think it's probably the best score of the year. It wasn't even nominated here. And so I do think that The Midnight Sky, which actually won the VFX Precursor Award, is a live dog at plus 275 if you want to get cute here. I really do. I think Tenet rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I think the way Christopher Nolan's acted over the course of the last year rubbed people the wrong way. I think the fact that there was that weird period where he made you see it in theaters, nobody went. Then, like, it still hasn't appeared for free on streaming. It doesn't debut on HBO Max until well after Oscar voting closes on May 1st. And it's not really the best movie to enjoy at home. So Midnight Sky was on Netflix, easy to watch. George Clooney directed it. So I think that's a live dog if you want to have some fun.
Is Midnight Sky any good?
Terrible. But that's the thing, is that it doesn't necessarily matter here, because, you know, a lot of people, when you have a movie like Tenet that's so polarizing, that's in the forefront there, I do think that people aren't going to really highlight the shortcomings of Midnight Sky. They're going to be like, man, I hate Tenet. I don't think Tenet should win an Oscar. And believe me, we've had, 3-6 Mafia won an Oscar for best song, you know, for Hustle and Flow. I believe it was not Birds of Prey, but Suicide Squad won an Oscar for makeup. So some bad movies have won Oscars over the years. And just because it's bad doesn't mean the visual effects aren't good. And so the fact that Tenet wasn't even nominated for score, a category that I think it maybe should have even been a contender in, tells me that people dislike this movie. They kind of dislike Christopher Nolan, who I think might be the best director, in my opinion. And I think this is just not a year where Tenet is going to be picking up awards where it's not an absolute runaway. And that movie, didn't even win at the Visual Effects Guild. So
I don't want to spoil tomorrow's episode, where we're going to have the pool picks and just go category by category, click yes. Who's going to be this pick. But I also have another discussion with a very special guest, Mr. One Tim Andercast. And we argue about Christopher Nolan and that. So maybe we should save that discussion for when we go through the pool picks a little bit, because he is under the same impression of you that Christopher Nolan is like the most important director of our generation. I just don't agree with that.
Yeah, I love the guy. I will say that, you know, some of his movies don't work 100% for me. I almost psych myself up too much for him sometimes, and I have to watch a movie again to truly appreciate it. I think Tenet is like the most Nolan-y movie ever, which is why I get why it's not like an easy sell for people. But I appreciate the ambition, and I appreciate that he goes for it. And it's like, you know, the same thing I love about movie trailers is what I love about Christopher Nolan movies. And like, it's like he thinks, you know, he thinks like a guy who's cutting a trailer together. He's like, how can I make every single one of these moments, you know, from the dialogue to the twists, to the visuals, to the effects, to everything, give you that boom feeling of like, you know, boom, you know, every time. And sometimes it's too much. Sometimes it doesn't work. But I really love the majority of his movies. And even the ones that I didn't love at the time, like Dark Knight Rises, I'm starting to come around on. And Tenet, which I saw in the theater, I was kind of confused by. I watched it at home with the subtitles and really fell in love with the score. So, but look, I will say what Christopher Nolan falls into the territory of is that people, myself included, who like him so much, and people like you probably think that we assume he can do no wrong, it begins to be, you know, it's not even your contrary. And you're like, all right, he's not Jesus, you know, like, come on, talk him down a little bit. Right. And I'll say that, you know, I don't think he, you know, the way people talk about Stanley Kubrick, you know, it's like, I don't know that, you know, he has not made a bad movie or two or have made a bad decision or seven. And same thing with Nolan. So I think that I get why people get annoyed how we've anointed him as this modern day Spielberg or modern day Kubrick. And I think he's kind of a combination of both in a way. But I really like his films. I love how eventized they are. To me, they always even an Interstellar, which I'm not high on, I don't love. I remember the 3 weeks leading up to it, and I've almost never been more excited for a movie. So few people do that for me. Quentin Tarantino's one of them, and Nolan's one of them, you know, but you get guys like Spielberg and all these other filmmakers, Scorsese, who have, you know, sort of gotten to that point in their career, and they still give you a terminal, you know, they give you a war horse, you know, I think to me, Nolan is still in that upswing. You know, he's still in that period where I'm still equally as excited to see everything he does, even when he doesn't fully deliver. And that's rarefied air for me. There's only maybe 5 people working right now that do that for me.
And I think my kind of pushback against it is that it's not that I dislike any of his movies. I think they're great. But just the comparison I wanted to make with him, and I'll make it to you, is what's the difference between, except for like budget, essentially, between Christopher Nolan and David Fincher, except I like David Fincher's way more.
But I think Fincher's in that 5 too. So, I mean, to me, that's like saying, okay, here's my knock on LeBron. He doesn't shoot as well as Steph Curry. And I'd be like, yeah, I mean, Steph Curry is the best shooter ever. So yeah, no one does. You know?
No, but I guess my point is like when people don't talk about Fincher in those terms, like, How?
Well, because again, you talk about the budget, and here's what I'll say. So for me, you know, Nolan has decided that he is, for the most part, other than if you take maybe Memento out of it and you take
The Prestige. You know,
Prestige, which I think is one of my favorite Nolan movies, but again, it still kind of has the feel of a big budget movie, especially when you look at the cast and it's so well made. I think like Memento and Insomnia are the only two that kind of, and even Memento with the scene, I mean, Insomnia with the Scenics feels big. That's what he does, is every time it's bigger, it's louder, it's you know, and Fincher does not do that. And so Fincher, you know, I think when Fincher gives you what I call quintessential Fincher, which is a Fight Club, a Seven, a Social Network, a Gone Girl, right? Where everything's kind of in sync and you do not know what's going to happen. And there's a level of tension where, you know, like in Gone Girl, where that moment in Gone Girl, where she, have you seen Gone Girl?
Yes. Obviously? Yeah. Okay. We'll throw out the spoiler alert for people. You can hit the
spoiler alert for Gone. I will try to be very vague, but there's a moment in Gone Girl where Rosamund Pike is with Neil Patrick Harris. And she does something to him and a music cue hits and something happens. And I'm not going to give away, but it's very graphic. And that to me is like, that is Fincher, the same way that there's elements of set. And it doesn't have to necessarily be violent or graphic, but the same way that, you know, you have, you know, stuff in Fight Club, you have stuff in Seven, you have that. Again, occasionally he makes a Curious Case of Benjamin Button and you're like, all right, that was a miss. He makes a Mank and that was a miss. But he isn't going for the bigness of it. He, I think, is going for the cerebral tension of it and the unsettling nature of, okay, I'm a very polished filmmaker. Like, to me, he reminds me more of like a Hitchcock, you know, but like almost, I think, even like a higher degree of, you know, precision. And when you bring in the Reznor scores and stuff like that, like, I think to me, I put him on the similar pedestal with Nolan. The difference is Nolan's going to come out with a movie that I want to see in IMAX and I want to see it loud. And I probably want to make sure I don't have something ruined for me or whatever. And Fincher is going to have something that might like attack me in my soul and that like I need to see again like the next week. And both of them achieve that 75% of the time. You know, and they're just shooting for different things. And so, look, I think that we haven't seen Nolan really try to do Mank. You know, the closest you would say is maybe Dunkirk, where, you know, he's coming off of Dark Knight trilogy, Inception, which was this big, epic, dream-laced spy thriller, but again, felt Dark Knight-y in its scope and action. Then he hits you with Interstellar, which is weird space, kind of crazy Nolan thing. They're all on the same level, right? Then he goes Dunkirk. Right. And that to me is the closest you're going to get to like what Fincher did with Mank, which this is obviously a very personal story for a British person. It's one that the average American or Canadian, I'd imagine, doesn't really know, this kind of smaller war story, these people who are left for dead and the kind of, you know, everyday folk who went and saved them on the boats and stuff. But even that movie, he did the Nolan way. Right. And so you got the Hans Zimmer score, Tom Hardy's in it and this and that. And I think it's like the least Nolan-y of his modern day movies because it's not like big and epic as far as like the spies and the stuff. But he does the Nolan version of it. And I think you watch that movie in IMAX. It delivers. It's big. It's loud. Fincher, to me, like Mank is like a true departure of everything you look for in a Fincher movie. And so I just think that with Fincher, he swings, I think, a little bit more, you know, and those are the movies I would point out, and sometimes misses. And I think you don't get that from Nolan. You kind of get the same lane. And the farthest he's ever, to me, derailed from it lately is Dunkirk. Tenet, for instance, a lot of people think he failed with it, but Tenet to me is like, it's like Inception turned up to 15. You know, it's like literally it's he's doubled down on everything. You know, it's like stuff barely makes sense, but he's doing stuff backwards, his explosions and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know. I get it. I get the Nolan detractors. It's fine. I'm not saying he's perfect. But to me, you know, I put him in a category with Fincher, with Tarantino, with Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, who are guys who it's just like, you know, Jordan Peele, I kind of even put there now. You know, they're making a movie. Sign me up. Day it comes out, earliest I can see it, you know. And I don't even say that for like Scorsese or Spielberg anymore, because they're not as, you know, just over the course of 40 years, their batting average is lower. Doesn't mean they're not Hall of Famers, but they hit 270, you know?
You can follow Scott Jaeger on Twitter at Shot of Jaeger. You can check out the Challenge Mania podcast, and you probably do want to follow him on Twitter in case he's tweeting out some of these early lines on some of the Oscar awards that we can go bet on. And you can catch him tomorrow on the Pat Mayo Experience as we go through category by category and make our Oscar cheat sheet if you're entering pools and anything like that. Plus, we'll continue our discussion about Christopher Nolan along with Tim Anderkust as part two of that show tomorrow as well. Remember to smash the like button to the episode and leave your favorite bet in the comment section. Subscribe to Mayo Media Network. I'm Pat Mayo. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time.
Pat Mayo Experience! Experience!